everyone. We're going to start this morning's hearing with the Clerk of the House. Thank you very much for attending the Paris and Rochester Christmas. So the way we do it is you can launch straight into questions if you like, but you may wish briefly to say a few things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a few brief remarks to make, but I'm certainly not intending to read my submission. Just firstly to say that I wasn't involved in the release of the data to the Henry Inquiry, so really I can't throw any light on what actually happened. But I have given considerable thought...
Can I just ask you on behalf of the members, could you speak into the microphone?
Okay. But I've given considerable thought to why the particular turn of events may have occurred, and I feel that Parliament has been let down, and that concerns me, and I'm concerned about what my office can do differently to make sure that we react in a different way in the future, and the knowledge that we have and the experience that we have can be fully brought to bear on these sorts of situations. So my submission sets out what I believe is important in considering requests for information, some reflections on what may have led to an environment in a parliamentary agency where independence of parliamentary independence was not a paramount consideration, and then just comment a little bit on what we as the parliamentary agencies are doing about that. In terms of what's important in considering information requests, I think there needs to be clarity about the nature of the inquiry to which an agency is responding, the powers of inquirers and the intersection with the powers of the House, and then who owns the information. The investigation of a potential offence, a serious breach of security, for instance, is quite different to where dealing with a leak, a political inconvenience. And one end of the spectrum, there are no particular powers, and at the other, maybe dealing with the execution of a search warrant. So, and I think I've just had a bit of a look. There are a number of bodies that have statutory powers to inquire and obtain evidence that could be used in these circumstances. And the New Inquiries Act provides powers. The Human Rights Commission has powers. The Broadcasting Standards Authority, the Ombudsman. And I think there is a tendency to seek to use these powers without regard to the powers and immunities of the House. It's more a matter of unawareness and about the need to balance particular powers against parliamentary independence. And I acknowledge Parliament's not above the law, but there are certain powers there to protect its independence, in particular the power to control its own operations and immunity from proceedings in Parliament being questioned, in other words, free speech. And I think the intersection of the law there with these powers and immunities is where guidance from this committee would be really useful to us. In terms of access to information, it is complicated because the Parliamentary Service holds information as an agent, and there are many owners of that information, and different access arrangements will apply. The Clerk is the custodian of parliamentary proceedings on behalf of the House. Those proceedings are absolutely protected, but a large amount of them in the electronic form is held by the Parliamentary Service. The Parliamentary Service holds ministerial records for DIA, and they're subject to the official information. It also holds records not protected by privilege and not covered by the OIA. Members' representative and party records, members' personal records, and then finally the records that are the administrative records of my office and the Parliamentary Service. So while the OIA may apply in some contexts, or one particular context really, it shouldn't be used as a backdoor means of general access. And I think in terms of guidance, the Law Commission has done some very instructive thinking on this, and it's worth reflecting on that. Also, the privacy principles. While the Privacy Act does not apply to the Parliamentary Service or members, those principles are really valuable in trying to establish some protocols. I think it's the category of members' representative and party information and their personal information which poses most difficulties. It's not protected as as if it were proceedings in Parliament and it's not subject to the OIA regime, which has some protections. And currently our thinking there is that we should work through a number of steps where there are requests for that sort of information. Firstly, recognising that the Parliamentary Service is an agent and it's holding that information as an agent, and it has no role to disclose that information.
Agent for whom?
For whoever is the owner of the information. It's variable. It may be ministers, it may be members, it could be my office, it could be the Department of Internal Affairs. So there's a whole lot of different owners, rather.
Right, so you say it's not determined by who holds the card, like my card is not owned by me.
Oh no, I'm talking about electronic information.
Oh, generally.
Yeah, yeah, not specifically card information. I think where there are requests for information, the permission of the owner should be sought. It's necessary to clarify a process for that access to that information. And I believe the Parliamentary Service shouldn't be the place that access is obtained. It should be the owner who provides the access. It's necessary to advise the owner of the information of the right to claim privilege and possibly have a representative present if they're not present themselves when any sort of search occurs or any examination of information. And where privilege is claimed, for the clerk or a representative of the clerk potentially to be present to deal with any issues about proceedings in Parliament, and possibly to have the Speaker ultimately as the determiner of what is a proceeding in Parliament issue a certificate in the way that is suggested by the Law Commission. So I think the committee has the power, or has been given the exercise really, of looking at a protocol, and working through the existing protocols would be informative, but it's also, you might want to know that the House has the power to issue guidelines to the Ombudsman, and they may be something that would become a standard more generally, because the Ombudsman does have quite significant powers to examine information where she is looking at a complaint about official information not being supplied. There is one smaller, I think, more technical issue, and that is around metadata that would be worthy of looking at. How should metadata be treated? Should it be treated in a different way from the content of an email or other associated documents? And from my discussions with members, I feel I've reached the conclusion that the metadata around emails, at least, can provide a lot of information about with whom members are meeting and talking and what they're meeting about. And that is information that probably shouldn't be released, and those sorts of things could be addressed in any protocol. So in terms of the environment that created a climate where an appreciation of parliamentary independence wasn't paramount, I think there's just a couple of risks I want to touch on. And the first is Section 9 of the Parliamentary Service Act, which provides for the service to provide services beyond core parliamentary services, those core services required by the House and members. I think any further expansion there needs some more careful consideration to the extent that it might dilute that primary purpose for the Parliamentary Service and the original objective of independent agencies serving the Parliament and responsible to the Speaker. So Section 9 does pose something of a risk. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that in the parliamentary environment, our processes for dealing with information are not probably as well ingrained as in departments. We don't, because the OIA doesn't cover most of the work that we do, we're not regularly dealing with official information requests. But we have given considerable thought to this area in the work that we did with the Law Commission review of the OIA. And I think my office probably needs to share that more widely with the Parliamentary Service so that we're aware of some of the difficulties, because they certainly were well canvassed in that work that we did for that review. So what are we doing to deal with those risks? I think you can have all the structures in place, but if the relationships and culture isn't right, then they're not going to work. I mean, that's something about running an organisation. So we are working on some informal governance arrangements that are really focused around getting greater collaboration, more sharing of strategy and establishing some common outcomes for ourselves and the parliamentary service, and with the aim of creating a culture where issues are shared and escalated across the agencies if necessary. We might also take an opportunity to look to see whether there are some better information technology developments that we can harness to help with this. And because of that, we've looked at an advisory board that would also have potentially an IT specialist on us to help us deal with some of these issues. The idea of the advisory board is that it's an informal group that would be sponsored by the Speaker, and it would help us with our kind of strategic governance setting of outcomes. So we don't have anybody. The government sets outcomes for departments. We don't have that process. It's informal at present, but I think it will help and could potentially help with the risk of service expansion proposals under Section 9. And, I mean, even going as far as the independent determination of members' services to ward off the criticism that is rife about the use of the privilege of exclusive cognizance, which underpins parliamentary independence, but is often criticised as being self-serving. I mean, if the services were set by an independent parliamentary body rather than one appointed by the government for quite a different purpose and serviced by the government, you know, that would be a step ahead for Parliament, but that's really another matter beyond the scope of this inquiry, so I'll leave it at that. And finally, I just think there is some work to do around rebuilding relationships with the media, and our approach to doing that is through the communication strategy that the Standing Orders Committee endorsed us developing in 2011. There's quite a number of things that we're working on there.
Thank you very much. There's nothing in what you've said that I'm concerned that would necessitate a change to any of the legislation governing this place?
No, the work that we're doing around the advisory board, as I say, is informal, and it's not part of our strict accountability structure, which is from the general manager or myself to the Speaker, but it involves the Speaker. So I think it's important that we keep the Speaker involved in that.
Yeah, no doubt for that. Questions?
We're both appointed separately as with slightly different processes, but as chief executives reporting to the Speaker, and we are responsible to the Speaker for the administration of our offices. And I have more independence. The Speaker doesn't direct me in the same way as he directs services that the Parliamentary Service provides, but I don't think that makes a huge difference to the way that I interact with the general manager. Our practice with Mr. Thorne was to meet every fortnight, and those were informal meetings where we would just discuss how anything was going and any issues that might affect both agencies. But we have, over a number of years, been increasing the number of what we call shared services. So the Parliamentary Service now provides almost all of our IS, information services, services in terms of our computer hardware, and we provide them with legal services. We're working on more shared policy services, so there's quite a lot of common work, and what we're trying to do is formalise that a little bit through the advisory board.
And so in this particular matter, you weren't advised?
No. I became aware of it through an informal conversation at one of our fortnightly meetings when I was talking to the general manager about the difficulties I was facing with the position of the United Future Party and some of the pressures I was coming under there. It just is an informal conversation.
So that was after the meetings?
Yeah, it was in June.
Right, so this protocol that you're suggesting that will be something different?
I think so, and I think to me, it's unfortunate that Jeff is gone because we were making a lot of progress on the shared services. And so, this has had a bit of an impact on that, but, we have to continue that work.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to sense that we justify access to logs about who's going in and out of buildings. Is that what you mean by that?
Well, I think you have to look at what the situation is, the powers of the inquirer, and then balance that against the powers of the House. And so you weigh up whether you've got a serious security issue or whether it is more of a, as I said in my submission, a political... And so there's going to be various grades of... So you've got a spectrum, really.
Mr. Banks, in an earlier, talking to an earlier witness, asked the witness whether the line should be strict line as to criminality, and that you should use official processes like warrants to get information, and in the normal privileges that people understand that there's a warrant there, and the normal privileges apply to protect self-incrimination or journalist freedoms. Do you have a view as to whether we should be drawing a bright line like that and say, well, just pursue your remedies, and if you haven't got a legal remedy, you can't have it?
Yeah, well, I don't know that that's entirely helpful, because if you look at the kind of spectrum of persons that have powers and the nature of those powers, if you can cover off a warrant procedure, but you've still got a number of powers that don't require a search warrant, but it's still quite extensive. And looking at the Ombudsman's power to obtain information when she's investigating a complaint, well, they're quite extensive, and they are, you know, there is a direct conflict with the powers of the House there. And my view is that there isn't a way. I don't believe that Parliament should every time that sort of power is given, legislate for the powers of the House and try and sort that out in legislation. I think parliamentary privilege should always speak, and what that means is there needs to be a way of working that out. And to me, it is getting together with the inquirer and sorting out how a process to get through it.
Well, in respect of the there's a couple of points that I'd just like to tease out. One is in respect of the Ombudsman's powers. If the Ombudsman was to come and she was to receive a complaint in respect of information that is held by parliamentary services and on behalf of DIA and or the minister, that would be dealt with by her through the minister in the future, do you think? Or do you think she should ever be able to come to parliamentary services and try and get it in direct route into the information?
No, I don't believe so. I can't prevent her, obviously, approaching the parliamentary service, but as I said, I think the process needs to be to look at who is the owner of the information that is the subject of the inquiry and direct the inquiry there.
So I agree with you in respect of the Ombudsman. In respect of your reference to Parliament's privileges, are you referring to parliamentary privilege in the Harrison that which is absolutely privileged? Or are you referring to something that is broader than that, which is one of the rules surrounding what we do as members of Parliament in a way that enables us to go about our business without our parliamentary business being unduly looked into by people who shouldn't have a right to what is private? Now, can I give you an example? If we had someone coming into an office making an allegation to a member of Parliament of corruption, we want that sort of thing to be brought out through the parliamentary system, and you know, it can't always start in Parliament. It has to actually start by someone raising it with a member of Parliament who might raise it in Parliament and put it into the public in a way that's absolutely privileged. But the background step is a public interest in members of Parliament being able to go about their business privately. Now, I think there's an interest here in privacy that goes beyond absolute parliamentary privilege in that narrow definition of parliamentary proceedings, which we nevertheless need to protect. Can I ask you a general question first, and then I've got a particular one?
Well,
do you agree with that?
Yeah, I see parliamentary proceedings as connected to transaction of the business of the house, not limited to what goes on the floor of the house or in the committee. And, you know, as you know from Lee, that it can include conversations, material that is provided that relates ultimately to something that is transacted in the house, but it does not include all of the things that members do.
So I agree that all of the things that parliamentarians do aren't subject to absolute parliamentary privilege. In respect of those things that aren't absolutely privileged, because I think we're pretty clear about what they are absolutely privileged, in respect of other issues, do we then just resort to, who owns the information? And if that information, which is private to the Member of Parliament, including who's coming to visit them, including their emails, and including their access records, that is the information of the member. Is that the appropriate way to look at it? And well, unless someone's got a right to look through that, whether that information becomes public or not, is a matter for the member to give consent to. And if the member doesn't consent, shouldn't the rule be that no one's entitled to it unless they've got a legal right to it and they can force it out of them?
Well, I tend to agree with you on that. I think that's the way they handle it in Australia. And in the UK, they've got slightly different arrangements where they, under their Data Protection Act, they do recognise members as a sort of an entity. I think they call it the data controller or something like that. So they actually recognise that members themselves have information that's not part of the proceedings. So there are varying ways of doing it. I mean, an informal way that involves the protocol does mean that ultimately there could be a test in court. The Australians have not, they follow a similar sort of idea, and they don't release member information, but they say it's not been tested in court.
We put it as a privileges committee applying to what we think the rule is, rather than inquiring, creating something that's just this rule. The last question is, if you extend that to other participants in the parliamentary process, like people who might be coming into Parliament to make an allegation of corruption, or a journalist who might have interactions with a member of Parliament, because both of them have got access trails in our modern communications situation. Do you have a view as to similar rules applying there? That who does that information belong to?
I suppose that when it is, but to the extent that it's in the member's possession, it belongs to the member. There are other journalists have other protections that apply to them in terms of their sources and things like that.
Can we just tease that out a bit? Because I'm not sure that I think it's right that it's within the members of Parliament's right to obviously the member of Parliament knows something, then he or she can say about it. What about this, the visiting person making an allegation of corruption, or the journalist chasing down information? Where's the principle that lies behind when and if that information ought to be disclosed?
Well, I think, an individual would have protections under the Privacy Act, and I think that's what would need to be relied on, and journalists have the same protection, but they also have other protections around their sources.
Well, is that right? Because we only had a Privacy Act for the last 3 years, and I don't think that those rights, the rights of protecting the way in which Parliament exercises its rights in order to protect democracy, that's a technical
problem. Yeah, that's right.
They predate Privacy Act, so I just could you give some thoughts to what principle? I don't want to catch you on the hop because we've been thinking about it, and we haven't got all the answers. But I'd quite like to see if we can articulate a principle the MP one, I think, was virtually very
good. Yeah. But it's that step further.
The journalist one, I think, arises from the rights of the importance of the fourth estate. The third party one, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's something we can certainly give some thought to and come back to.
Dr. Smith, in your submission, you've rightly pointed out the important constitutional separation between the executive and Parliament. Have you given consideration, given the natural tension that there will always be and should be, between the between the institution and Parliament and the executive as to whether it's appropriate for the telephone and information systems to effectively be integrated directly together. Look, for instance, in the UK, ministers' offices are quite separate, often separate departments. If we look at the US, you have a complete constitutional separation of the executive from the Congress. Is it a matter where, for a sort of for convenient state, we have the same telephone system, so our journalists in the press gallery, and Parliament and ministers, and actually departmental staff that work in ministers' offices, are all on the same telephone system, they're all on the same IT system, and then you get a contractor that doesn't understand the fine points of constitutional propriety between the two, gets confused, doing inquiry into what is ministers' business, does that raise the question as to whether we actually should have a more reliable or effective between VI and Parliament and a separate telephone information system that enables us to maintain that proper constitutional separation down to the system of IT that in today's world has become so important?
It certainly concerns me, and in 1984 when it started out, the idea was that there would be a separation, but information technology developments are such that I believe it is impractical. I mean, I think there are risks in the parliamentary service providing that service to ministerial services and for ministers. And from my point of view, what started me addressing it was around the priorities, because they're also providing an IT service to us, and where does the priority lie? My view is it should lie with the House. But, you know, there's a tension there as well. But while we all inhabit the same piece of a real estate, it is probably impractical to have separate systems. And I know that ministers ministers and members change places, not too often, but reasonably often. Yeah, I didn't thought of that, sorry. And so there needs to be, you don't want to have to get a new phone every time something like that happens, and it's inconvenient, but I mean, that's something that could be looked at. But in terms of providing a service right across the parliamentary complex, the parliamentary service has endeavoured to provide services to the executive and Parliament, and I think that has caused some tension.
Have you looked, though, internationally at Parliament, that's got the same dilemma of the sovereign tension that exists between the executive and Parliament, and how many of them actually have the integrated system that we do? The informal contact I've had with parliamentary colleagues around the Commonwealth, and is that actually that have parliamentary system like us, they don't have
mostly they don't
systems right into the parliamentary system, and I wonder whether that has been at the course of what has gone so wrong in the system.
In fact, in Australia, it's almost the other way around, that the government actually deals with member services through a department, as opposed to they have a parliamentary service department, but the service delivery of member services is mainly handled by the Department of Finance and Administration or something like that. So it's almost the opposite way around. So our position of having us all on the same piece of real estate creates some difficulties, and that's why I think we maybe need to look at whether there are some smarter IT solutions to help kind of create that separation, but without creating inconvenience, particularly for ministers.
You see, if you take ministers, we change pay rolls. When you're a backbench member of Parliament, you're on different pay, comes different rations as compared to the minister. If it's important enough to get pay roll, why would it not be important as a sense of information that ends up on your IT systems, and that being separated with far greater sensitivity?
Well, that's really the reason why I drew attention to Section 9, because it was under Section 9 that the services to ministerial services were developed, and I think a bit more thought needs to go into the way in which Section 9 of the Parliamentary Service Act is used.
Is that something that you would have said?
mean, those issues have to be raised with the Speaker because Section 9 can only be used with this proof as... Oh, in terms of this particular event with the Henry Inquiry, no, they weren't. But, I mean, I do raise those issues, but there are, you know, there are cost savings and economy of scale issues that I get told about, so, you know, there's a... With the benefit of hindsight, you know, what I would have done, because this is my usual practice, is to think about, well, do we have any precedents here? And I think, well, we don't have a direct precedent, but we do have some protocols that are, particularly the search protocol that was developed very quickly to deal with the search on the Honourable Tito Philip Field's office. I think it does provide some very good principles, and it provides for the Speaker to be informed at every step of the way. And so that's, you know, that I hope would have been my starting point, but, you know, that's with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah,
Dr. Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue that we've in part raised about, which is the common IT platform, how the Parliamentary Services gives to all the Parliament. That is a fairly recent, as I understand it, that's a fairly recent development, somewhere around late 2011. And before that, they were separate.
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact date.
My understanding is that it was late 2011. And the rationale for that appears to be in the Parliamentary Service Statement 10 for the 5-year period 2012 to 2017. And it effectively, it explicitly rationalises that on the basis of economies of scale within tight financial constraints. So just quoting from that statement, the Parliamentary Service has continued to expand its partnership with other agencies to realise economies of scale, particularly in the provision of ICT, which it has expanded to include ministerial offices. The network expansion reduced the cost of services overall, avoiding the cost of a network upgrade. The service previously provided to ministerial offices. The service is now looking to expand its provision of network services to other agencies on the precinct with a view to further reducing costs or achieving economies of scale. Over the next few years, the service will continue to seek to share services where there are clear savings to be realized. The whole rationale is focused in on economies of scale within the tight financial constraints. This is late 2011, thereabouts. At that stage, were you or anyone else to your knowledge brought in on any discussion about the constitutional implications of that change?
If I recall rightly, I did have some informal discussions with the Speaker about the advisability of this, and my view was to be careful because, you know, there are issues in terms of, and the way I approach it is what was around, because I wasn't thinking of this particular circumstance, was around how do you determine priorities when you expand the service like that, when, if you look at Section 7 or 8 of the Parliamentary Service Act, the service is there to provide services to the House and members. So how do you balance... That's the approach I was taking, and those were my concerns at that time.
So I understand and accept that you're effectively saying that one has to be careful as opposed to not proceeding. And I do see that the currently operative statement of intent still remains. Over the next 3 years, the service will continue to seek to share services where there are clear savings to be realised. In light of what has happened, would you now advise that not proceed?
I think in 2011, that probably referred to more sharing with the Office of the Clerk, and I don't think there are risks there because we both agencies servicing Parliament. So I think the work that we are doing on shared services does not pose the same sort of risk. So it's quite possible that that statement and the statement of intent, the Parliamentary Service Statement of Intent, refers to...
Is it the same paragraph that refers to ministerial services?
Yeah. Well, I guess the only... I mean, the Parliamentary Service provides some services in the Parliamentary Council Office, but I'm not aware of any other expansion except in terms of the services that it provides for the Office of the Clerk.
Yes, could I ask you, with respect to your bottom paragraph, page 2 and top, page 3, it's, you were saying that people might perceive themselves not only acting as ministers, but as leaders or as MPs, but what is the determinant factor here as to how they were acting? I'll put it this way. If your MP would not be sitting on, for example, a serious ministerial body, getting serious information like the GCSB and SIS, that sort of information, and then trying to say, well, I'm just a simple MP and I'm not therefore responsible like a minister was. So what's the determining factor that you consider with respect to that paragraph you wrote?
Well, I guess the way I would look at it is ministers have particular responsibilities and warrants that cover particular portfolio areas. So that is where their responsibilities exist. The other things that they do are, you know, likely to be constituency things, or they may have formal roles on, say, the Parliamentary Service Commission, which are not necessarily related to being a minister. And on the Intelligence and Security Committee, you have to look at how that committee is established to determine whether or not a member may or may not be there in a ministerial capacity, I guess. I don't think there's any actual dividing line, except to me, you look really at, well, what are the ministers' portfolios, to what do they relate, and if there's some other activity, well, then it's quite possible that a minister might be dealing with that other activity as a member or a party leader.
You would accept that that committee is a pretty exclusive privilege committee that most members of cabinet will not be on.
But it does, I mean, it does have members who are not ministers on it, and if you're talking about Mr. Dunn, and you look at his ministerial responsibilities, well, they don't, you know, I don't see a connection with the GCSB there, or the SIS.
Yeah, Chair Parker. I think it's a bit too narrow, because the Parliamentary Service Commission is not just about ministers, it's about the
I mean, to a large extent, I don't think there is a dividing line. And from a parliamentary point of view, I'd take the member's word. How did the member consider he or she was operating at the time? But because there isn't, I don't think there's a particular way of defining.
So you do not think one of the determining factors is the nature of information that they have acquired themselves?
Well, it might be Mr. Park suggests that it came through a cabinet process. Well, that relies on your being a minister, but ministers get information from other sources as well.
All right. Can I ask this? In your second paragraph, you talk about a serious security breach involving a potential criminal offence and occasional release of personal information to the police, etc., etc. But the excerpt really of this nature now. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? Because you complain to the police that a serious crime has been committed, you itemise the statute that you're alleging. This some people's view of a crime to leak a state secret. If the police position is, well, show us the proof, then where do you get them to actually do their duty by the statute that they're seeking action on? By chicken egg, I mean, you're going to wait till the police get involved before you demand this information. You are then consigned to an outside institution a range of decisions which should be preserved in this house.
Oh, well, I mean, if I mean, the criminal offences are investigated by the police, but the House has certain powers to deal with other matters, and it's got extensive powers to require its members to give information and others to give information. So I don't see a conflict there in terms. And my point really is about when you're dealing with this as someone who holds information, you need to look at what is the nature of the inquiry and what powers does the inquiry have, and that's really what I'm getting at. And in this instance, I think it's instructive that the inquiry had very few powers, no powers really. But if you were dealing with the police, on the other hand, and they may well come with a search warrant, and then we have protocols to deal with that and put some safeguards in place for members to deal with it.
Just one last question then, because if you go to your conclusion, which is that it doesn't involve any kind of situation that the journalist can manage that in the future, but you suggest that there is no precedent for what you say here. Now, I find it very hard to believe that there is no precedent, because there has been precedent in this matter on the access of private information.
I've said there's no precedent, and I think there's...
Well, you said we don't have any precedent here. That's
exactly what... Yeah. We haven't confronted, as far as I know, an inquiry of that exact nature where there are no powers, but information is being sought. We have confronted a number of different situations where there have been requests for information from members about themselves. We've confronted the search warrant. So there are relevant examples of similar sorts of things. There's probably not a direct precedent for this particular circumstance, but to me, that's why I would always look for what else has happened and what can I learn from those other experiences, and they are important.
Well, can I just suggest that there is precedent, and not all people, but the fact is, you were sitting there as a person on the committee some years ago, where the very same request was made on that day, and there's never no back then from anybody. No one on the institution thought that was wrong. So why is it not a precedent now?
But that was if I know what you're talking about, that was a committee which has powers to call for persons and records asking for information. This was an inquiry, with the Henry inquiry, with no powers. This committee has very extensive powers, which no other select committee has. The Speaker has similar powers if a select committee requests him to exercise them, but this committee has significant powers to call for persons, papers and records and to deal with people who don't meet their requests. So I find it's a different situation.
Control to have an inquiry with all the requisite powers that you say were actually for this inquiry?
It could have been, and I think that perhaps is instructive.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?